This is Joe Atwell with Jerry Russell, and this will be a Revolution Radio broadcast of ours. But we have a very special guest today, and so we're recording it because of his schedule. And his name is Giles Gaffney. Hello, Giles. How are you?
Hi, Joe. Hi, Jerry. How are you?
We're great here.
Good. So, Giles, we're going to talk about Caesar's Messiah and specifically about your own research into sort of the typologic connections between Josephus and the Gospels. Would you like to describe your research to us?
Oh, okay. Yeah, sounds good. All right. Well, why don't I start with a bit of sort of personal background information?
Please do. Yes.
About myself. Firstly, I'm a very, very big fan of Joe in terms of his main work, Caesar's Messiah, but also his more general articles and podcasts about government propaganda, mind control, you name it. So I met Joe briefly at the Covert Messiah event in London.
I remember it well. I remember it well.
You remember that one?
Yeah, then? Absolutely.
I
yes.
Think it was October.
I wish we could have spent more time together. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. It was a bit of a tight schedule. Yeah, lots of people there. And you gave a lot of speeches and a long presentation. But yeah, I mean, I discovered Joe's work earlier in that year of 2013. I don't remember how I discovered Caesar's Messiah, but I've always been interested in history and understanding the Bible, etc. Like Jerry, I was also interested in the 911 truth movement. So I hope a lot of truth seekers are tuned into this and will be interested in the real deal, which is Caesar's Messiah. By the way, my copy of Caesar's Messiah is so worn out that the pages have literally turned yellow. And it's signed by Joe, but I don't think I could ever sell it on eBay. And my three-year-old son, he's actually scribbled over Shakespeare's Secret Messiah, which is Joe's other work, which is kind of collaborated with Jerry Russell as well. He's basically scribbled over the in cover, and he's kind of tried to join the dots. And I think that was designed by Ryan Gilmore. He designed the actual front cover as well as the in cover, which is based on that.
You have done a lot of your own research, which of course I've been reading and am very impressed with. It just resonates really clearly with me, and it's obviously oftentimes an improvement over the analysis I did. So I was just wondering, would you like to talk a little bit about the kind of research that you've done?
Yeah.
and the things that you've sort of seen with your research?
When I first read Joe's book on Caesar's Messiah, the Roman conspiracy to invent Jesus, the whole thing, you know, totally made sense to me. I could see the verbatim matches between Josephus, the Jewish War, the Roman history book, the official history book of the first century for the Roman emperors, and the Gospels. So the correlation between those were sort of sticking out like a sore thumb. So you've got, like, for example, there's some very clear phrases that you would say are kind of the statistical probability of those happening by chance is extremely low between the Gospels and Josephus. So you've got phrases like the stones cry out when Jesus first enters Jerusalem. Same with Titus as well during his military campaign against the Jews. So the stones are said to cry out. You've got loose and bound, a combination of the words loose and bound, like when you're in shackles as a captive and then you become loosened. So those two words were kind of in both of the, in the same paragraph in the Gospels and in Josephus. And then when Titus first arrives, so Titus was the Roman emperor during the Jewish War. Well, actually, he got made emperor later. It was Vespasian first who was emperor, and then Titus became emperor kind of later on. So he cuts down the fruit trees. So, yeah, it's a bit strange. I mean, fruit trees on its own, you know, you could have that in any story. But actually cutting down fruit trees outside of Jerusalem in both books, all of that seemed pretty suspicious on the face of it. What really stood out for me was the doomsday prophecies or the eschatological prophecies that Jesus predicts. Now, for me, I believe that's the key part of the story. It's actually the largest block in the Gospels. So all of the Gospels are pretty much divided into different blocks with a kind of like a title for each block. You can go through the, you know, the synoptic Gospels or all four of the canonical Gospels, and you'll see that they're all divided up into blocks. And the largest block there is Matthew 23 to 25, where he talks about the doomsday prophecies. And now if you compare that with Josephus, you will see this is the main part where the Flavians, i.e. Vespasian, Titus, Domitian, This is the part they wanted to hit home more than any others. It's the time when Titus was sort of proclaimed emperor by the troops as well. So, you know, when he arrives at the Eastern Gate, he sets the standards at the Eastern Gate because he's coming from the west to the east. And in the actual Gospels, they describe the Son of Man traveling from east to the west and coming on the clouds. So, and Titus, sure enough, arrives at the Eastern Gate, sets down the eagles, the standards, and he's proclaimed emperor. But there's a lot more to that whole chunk in the Gospels and in Josephus, and it covers a whole chapter in Caesar's Messiah as well. So I don't know if maybe Jerry might want to talk a bit about the doomsday prophecies. I mean, in my Skype sort of mood message, I display that as in my mood message, hoping to attract attention from other people who may find it rather suspicious that, you know, you've got the woe saying Jesus, you have a number of signs, but maybe Jerry might want to talk a bit about that one.
Sure. Well, I totally agree that the woe saying Jesus in particular really stands out. And in Josephus, he's kind of this lunatic satirical character who is going around saying, "Whoa, whoa, whoa," just over and over and over again, and just repeats himself, never really elaborating on it, but using these few words that get repeated in the Gospels. And then suddenly is killed dead at the moment that Titus is conquering. And it really stands out how much parallel verbiage there is between this woe saying Jesus and the book in Josephus. And this is typically explained. Biblical scholars are aware of this. And they say, well, when the gospel writers went to write up the three canonical gospels, they read Josephus and made it to match. But to me, it's obvious that that it must have gone the other way around, that what's in Josephus is a satire of what the Christians are saying.
Right, and if I would just can just interject, I mean, it just makes absolutely no sense for people who are writing the story of Jesus Christ from a perspective of a follower of him to adopt verbiage about an insane lunatic Jesus that has a bad end, is crushed, because it would be the last person in the world that you would, take attributes from the, their life to try to interject them into this character that you are claiming is the Son of God. So the other way around, of course, makes perfect sense that this is a satire of the character in the Gospels. And that, incidentally, just from the, from the perspective of common sense, you can see that the character in Josephus, this crazy Jesus character, is a really good mockery of Jesus Christ. I mean, whereas Jesus, it makes no sense that he's a derivative from the Josephus Jesus. It makes perfect sense to read Josephus's Jesus as a mockery. It's just that the power of the Roman Christian Church to force people to take the character in the Gospels historically and seriously just keeps them from seeing something so obvious as this whole long vignette with all of this parallelism, just all kinds of obvious and very unusual language. The woe to Jerusalem, the bit about the bridegrooms and the bridesmaids, and so much parallelism that it insists that you have some opinion about it, and the obvious one is just that the character in Josephus is the satire.
Yeah, exactly. I would agree. Yeah, I mean, you've got the unusual word of bridegroom being matched up as well. And there's a lot of verbatim matches in there, a lot of unusual words and phrases such as false prophets, four winds, so which is to do with the Greek gods, the four winds. The bridegroom part is a reference from the Old Testament, I believe, to do with, I think, when the Babylonians came to Jerusalem in the past, they were a previous nation to have caused the Jews problems, and they took over Jerusalem or crushed the Jews in the same way that the Romans were doing in the Jewish War. And so they warned them that the same thing will happen again, almost by mentioning the bridegrooms and the bride. And yeah, the woe saying Jesus, he actually says woe in succession 8 times. And they actually cut one of the woes or censored it out of certain versions of the Bible. And if you go to Wikipedia and look up the woe saying Jesus there, it's called the Seven Woes of the Pharisees. But actually, it's 8. And they actually have a footnote in the Gospel saying that they've actually taken one of the woes out. Because if you put it side by side with Josephus, you will see that there's actually 8 in each of them. But the actual main part of that, I mean, the woe saying Jesus is just like a small part of the larger context of that parallel between the Gospels and Josephus. But it's actually about Jesus seeing into the future and predicting that the Son of Man will come, and that there will be a number of signs of this impending doom and the destruction of the temple, which actually does get demolished stone by stone, just as Jesus predicted it would. And then there's all these different signs, and there's so many of them, even a star above Jerusalem and some new ones that aren't mentioned in Caesar's Messiah, because there's just endless amount of data in that parallel. So,
right. And I was just going to say, John, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I just have this point that I wanted to make. When you remember that the passage in the Gospels that has Jesus talking about the woe to Jerusalem is basically a prediction of the events that are going to occur in Jerusalem. Right. I mean, during the war.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So that is the kind of the context that is just the surface narration that's obvious, and it connects the two passages. So now when you see the character in Josephus with all of these absolutely obvious parallels to the character in the Gospels, I think it's really the only coherent way to read the character in Josephus, but as a satire of the one in Jesus, because everything else about the passage in Josephus is related directly into the Gospels. So why would you not automatically then do the same thing with this character, Jesus? And if he is related to the Gospels, how else can he be related to the Gospels but as a satire of the character Jesus Christ?
Yeah, this Jesus character in the Gospels, supposedly living in 35 AD, is making predictions of things that are going to happen in 70 AD in great detail.
Yeah.
And so how can that be anything other than an indication that this Jesus character was in fact either invented or reinvented in 70 AD?
Exactly. It's perfectly clear. I mean, because everything in the passage which predicts the destruction of Jerusalem was obviously from someone who knew the details of the invasion of the city of Jerusalem. Everything is written after the fact, and the author of the Gospels has all of this awareness about the events that Josephus is describing. And so, again, it's just another direct link that is completely logical and normative, you know, just a regular way to read the text in the Gospel, is that it's derived from the events in Josephus. And so now the character in Josephus named Jesus, that has all of these experiences and is, you know, talks about the woe to Jerusalem, he's just obviously the basis. The authors are wanting the reader to experience this. They want the reader to recognize that's where the character comes from. He's a satire of the character in the Gospels.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is the point where they really lay the cards down on the table, because they reveal that Jesus is just a comical figure in so many ways. He's like a composite character, pretty much based on past deities, kings, prophets, and pretty much everything about him is just based on prefiguring Titus and setting up a few jokes here and there. So, the reason I think they really wanted this to hit home and they brought out the comical nature of Jesus, etc., is because this is the main part of the story. This is in the dual story with Jesus' ministry, Titus' military campaign. The whole point is the destruction of Jerusalem. They're there to destroy the Jewish revolt, the rebellion, and that culminates. It culminates in the destruction of the temple. So the temple, the burning of the temple, is the main part of the story. Hence, this is the main principal parallel out of about 50 that's been discovered in total. So yeah, I would say moving on, that Caesar's Messiah, I could see, particularly with those with that large parallel and lots of other bits dotted about in the dual stories with the such convincing verbatim, that it was highly, highly suspicious. And I knew Joe was onto something big. So, you know, I basically read the whole book, couldn't put it down. I've since read it several more times. And then I decided to basically start a new website, which was called Caesar's Messiah Proven. And I attempted to present Joe's work online, because he, you know, you had to purchase Joe's book, and you had a lot of scholars arguing about Joe's work without having actually read his book. So I decided to make a website that what it does is I attempted to present Joe's parallels, the ones I thought were valid, in such a way that could be understood through a series of pages that builds up the Flavian signature. That's the collection of parallels that show that it's the Flavians that authored this. So I wanted to show the Flavian signature like a model, where you keep adding to the model and building it up over a series of pages, beginning with verbatim, the shared concepts, the shared names. The only problem I had with Caesar's Messiah was the chapter on the Flavian signature. Half of it looked totally transparent and convincing, but other parts of the Flavian signature didn't seem to be the match that was intended by the authors. Because what happened was, when I was doing the website and I tried to put all the parallels into sequence, and they're all in sequence, but I couldn't fit the doomsday prophecies into the correct sequence. And so something seems wrong with the understood structure. And it was only recently, after 2 years of studying Joe's work, that I suddenly overcame these setbacks. And this was aided by a harmonization of the Gospels, because Joe pretty much shows the Flavian signature just using Luke alone. But I decided to bring in the other two synoptic authors. But also, I looked at a new translation of Josephus, because Joe relied only on the Wisden translation. Now, doing this, it basically opened up a whole new set of parallels. And so yeah, that's basically how I got to where we are now.
What translation did you use?
If you type in Google Josephus new translation, but they've translated the whole of Antiquities, which is Josephus' other works under the reign of Domitian. But the first was the Jewish War, I believe, that they published. And they also did the Life of Flavius Josephus, which is like an addendum to the Jewish War, and is actually helpful in understanding the chapter where they're in Galilee, where Josephus is in Galilee before the military campaign begins, and a bit of background information to Galilee. It goes a lot more in detail about that, and it also describes the crucifixions and things like that. So it's quite helpful to reference the life of Flavius Josephus when researching this subject as well. But yeah, you can see the new translation of Josephus. It complements the Wisden translation very well. And together, I mean, we have so many translations of the Gospels, but no one has really looked at Josephus. And even Joe has picked up on a lot of mistranslations from the original Greek, where Wisden just assumed that the sun cometh was the stone coming. Actually, he actually allowed that part to stay in the translation, but other parts he removed, like commanded to be pruned, I believe.
Right,
he took
right. And just to interject, that's like the most important passage in the entire, or one of the most important passages in the Wars of the Jews in relationship to the Gospels. And Wisden, because it made no sense, completely arbitrarily translated it as something that it didn't mean. And the whole vegetative humor, the mockery of the Jewish Messiah as the root and branch, was lost with Wisden's translation. And that was kind of a stumbling block for me. I had to try to figure out why the word was used in the first place, and had to do research into it, and then realize that it was a gardening expression. I didn't mean to slow you up, but that one word is an example of a lot of the problems that people have had in seeing the real meaning of Josephus, because Wisden did do quite a bit of arbitrarily translating. But Wisden, just to, he also saw things that modern scholars have a hard time seeing, which, for example, the abomination of desolation, which is just completely obvious, but from time to time scholars will disagree and say, well, it's not really the abomination of desolation, even though it's just flatly described as the end of the daily sacrifice. It has every attribute of the abomination of desolation, and it's 3.5 years from when the Flavians entered Jerusalem. Wisden had no trouble at all recognizing it. And of course, neither did any of the early church fathers. I mean, they all recognized that Josephus had basically shown that Jesus' prophecies had come to pass during the war, and that includes the his prediction of the abomination of desolation.
Okay. Yeah, because, I mean, it's very important that he commanded to be pruned, because it opens up that whole new root and branch theme, which is actually one of the most difficult chapters in Caesar's Messiah to grasp. But once you do grasp it, it's actually very rewarding to understand that. And you know, and it's again, it's another comical theme that the Flavians use in their literature. So, but yeah, talking about the abomination of desolation, I think with my research, which I tend to do when I'm kind of bored at work, or you know, I've done all my tickets, and then I'll just look at the Gospels, look at Josephus, and try to figure out some of the language that's being used in the symbolism, and try to work on the sequence that was begun by Joe in Caesar's Messiah. So you've got the abomination of desolation. What I found is that the second half of the Flavian Signature chapter, it looked a little bit problematic. And I think real progress was made when I realised that the Son of Mary, who was a human Passover lamb, and the abomination of desolation, those two parallels, they were correct, but they didn't quite line up in terms of the sequence. So they're all part of the larger story of the Caesar's Messiah thesis. So the abomination of desolation is basically when the sacrifice failed or was halted, because obviously Jerusalem, the Romans had arrived at the city and they had no one to carry on doing the daily sacrifice. So they had to put a stop to the daily sacrifice. Hence the Romans had arrived and the abomination of desolation, meaning Jerusalem will be left desolate and you know, there's no one to do the daily sacrifice. So in the larger scheme of things, those parallels are positive, but they're just not in the correct sequence. So there's like alternative parallels that you could match up, but the one that they intended was in a different section. And it's the same with the Son of Mary, who was a human Passover lamb. Jerry, maybe you could talk a bit about the Son of Mary, who was a human Passover lamb. So I know you covered this at the beginning of Shakespeare's Secret Messiah. You kind of give a recap into the Flavian Signature and some of these parallels that Joe originally presented in Caesar's Messiah, which are actually very crucial to understanding the Shakespeare typology as well.
So the Son of Mary, who was a human Passover lamb, that's a section in Josephus' Wars that talks about a Mary who is trapped in Jerusalem and is starving and has finally decided to eat her son and cook him up, and then she does it in a way similar to the way a Passover lamb would be prepared, and then she offers to feed some of it to Titus's soldiers, who turn away in horror. And the entire thing is fairly obviously talking about Jesus and his function as a human Passover lamb and the function of the Eucharist. Some scholars deny this and say, well, it's just talking about a Jewish Passover and a satire of that. But all things considered, there are several cues that make it clearly about the New Testament. And that whole thing is out of sequence with relation to the passages describing the Last Supper in the Gospels. And what you found was that there's a little section that refers to cannibalism and that refers to that Son of Mary passage that is in sequence.
Exactly, yeah. So what I actually found was that the Last Supper is obviously based on this story about the famine, when the Romans had laid siege to the Jews and starved them out. No one could exit the city or enter the city. So everyone is starving to death. They're hungry. And so they inserted this comical story. Well, it's not very comical. It's kind of satirical. So it's kind of dark humor. And yeah, it's about a woman called Mary who ate her son, roasted him first. There's mention of hyssop and all these things that point to a Passover style sacrifice. And yeah, that's obviously related to the Last Supper, but you have to take various parts of each story to build up the composite picture. But in terms of just the sequence running through the Gospels and Josephus chapter by chapter and trying to match up different blocks to different blocks, which is essentially what they were doing, then the part that actually matches the Last Supper, I found you could actually divide it into two parts that occur in two different parts of the dual story or the Flavian Signature. So the first part is they describe Mary roasting her son and eating him. That matches up to a parallel about who is the son of David, cross-reference to possibly the Old Testament. The second time, when Jesus is actually offering his body as bread and he offers his blood, he says, you know, drink this is my blood. Eat this is my body. And basically, in a Jewish war, it says here, if anyone's food was found, it was robbed and swallowed along with their blood. And their savagery would have made them eat even the corpses themselves.
Right.
Now, That is actually, that whole story is actually much larger, and it includes treading on the heads of the Jewish corpses. And in Caesar's Messiah, Joe refers to the Targum, and in there, they actually describe pressing grapes by treading on the grapes with their feet. So, yeah, one of the more complicated typologies between the Gospels and Josephus is the fact that Jerusalem had a wine press or an olive press in the Garden of Gethsemane, which means olive press, in a corner of Jerusalem. They actually had a wine press. It's actually mentioned in the Jewish War. They talk about a wine press being located there. And Joe shows that by looking at different parts of the Gospels and Josephus, Jesus kind of gets sort of pressed on the Mount of Olives in a garden named Gethsemane, which means olive press. And in these Son of Mary parallels, they talk about treading on the heads of the Jewish corpses. So it's not very nice, some of the humour. So that's kind of like the second part to the Son of Mary, who was a human Passover lamb.
Yeah, and I want to compliment you, Giles. When I read it, I knew that you were right. And when I wrote the Flavian Signature chapter, I was trying to take just two blocks of text and not manipulate the gospel side with too much material from the other synoptics, because I really wanted to show the simplest version of the sequence and the parallels that I could. That was really what I was trying to do. And there's actually a principle that the Romans used, which I don't talk about at all. I probably should have, but what I was trying to do with Caesar's Messiah, the Flavian Signature book that's out now, was just to show the sequence that was the easiest and clearest for people to understand so they could just get the concept. But if you look at what I call the primer to the Roman typology, which is the pre-ministry of Jesus that you see in Matthew, and you have all of these events from the Old Testament that are reused by Matthew to create the pre-ministry narrative of the character Jesus Christ. He actually, the author of Matthew, takes one of the Old Testament elements and puts it out of sequence. And that's the giving of the law, the Ten Commandments. And that's a typology in the Gospels of the Sermon on the Mount. And so what the actual typologic system that they use is they create a sequence, and they have the parallels that link it all together. But once the sequence is established, they can also put in things that are either only determined through puzzles in terms of where it should exist relative to its other half, and in other words, where the actual location of the linkages, and say if you're looking at the Gospels in Josephus. Or they'll just leave it on the wrong side of the event, which is what they do with the giving of the law, the Ten Commandments, and the Sermon on the Mount. I mean, if you look at the capture of the Mount of Olives, it isn't exactly right relative to the Passover lamb, but it's simply on the other side of it. And so what I think the principle the Romans are using here, because I'm pretty sure we're dealing with the sequence in Josephus, that's correct, is that they simply found that once they had enough sequential elements laid out, that they could basically then violate the sequence and still maintain what they saw as a comprehensible connection. But this idea is complicated. And so that was why, for example, I didn't put the capture of the Mount of Olives into the Flavian Signature chapter, because you kind of have to take the reader into a pretty complicated concept. And I was just hoping to make my case with a real simple version of it.
Yeah, no, I think you've done a really great job there, Joe. And, you've laid the foundations. And
that's why, one of the reasons why I was so happy when I was reading your stuff, because I could see that I pretty much had accomplished what I was hoping to. And you were the demonstration of it, because you were really finding the correct relationships at a more subtle level. And so that's kind of what we're dealing with, is it's very complicated. They've built up the typology to very complicated esoteric levels. And so, you have the primer in Matthew, the simple eight events in Matthew that link to the Old Testament. And then when you go forward, then some of the events are the obvious things, like the encircling the city with the wall, or raising the temple. You can see stuff like this very straightforward. But then when you get into other typologic elements, then it becomes more puzzle-like and more complex, and the reader, you know, really has to do some digging to get to the truth.
Okay, yeah, I think that's very useful what you just said, actually, because we've pretty much got parallels for every single block in the first 30% of the Gospels now, from when Titus begins his first military campaign, Jesus begins his ministry. The part that I couldn't match up was the Sermon on the Mount. I had to leave that bit out. I couldn't find a match for that. But I'm glad you mentioned that it's kind of included in the part where they're introducing the typology, using the Old Testament to link to the New Testament before they start to link to Josephus from the New Testament. And yeah, I agree with what you're saying, Joe, that the way that they structured the typology, etc., the Gospels, and to try to hit home that it was the Flavians who had actually authored all of these books and literature, was that they want you to possibly start with the doomsday prophecies first, then start to work with the sequence of parallels, start to notice throughout the books that there's, you know, similar concepts in each and verbatim even. And then once you've built up the entire sequence, which we are kind of coming to the end of doing, I still believe there's more parallels to be found, but I still think we are closing in on the entire sequence now. And once you've finished matching up the sequence, you're then left with a few isolated parts, and then you've got like entire themes that run through the whole literature that you can start to build up using what you've learned from the sequence. So there's a logical way, step by step, of progressing through the evidence in all these books being read in parallel. And so yeah, you start with obvious stuff first, matching things up in sequence. You then look at the isolated parts. You know what certain words mean when they're talking about demon-possessed Jews. They're talking about the hot-headed Jews who have a rebellious spirit. And so you know, whenever you hear demons, you know what they're referring to. So you don't need Josephus anymore. You can read isolated parts of the Gospels and understand that, then you can start to build up the more complex themes and events, like the Mount of Olives capture, where Jesus is sweating like blood, almost like grapes that are being pressed or olives that are being pressed. But again, that further down the road, you start to understand those kinds of jokes. Just to finish up on the Son of Mary, who was a human Passover lamb, there's a chapter in Matthew 22. They talk about the Son of David, and it's cross-referenced to Hebrews 10. Now, in Hebrews 10, the whole of that is all about sacrifice. So that's how you know that when they talk about the story of the Son of Mary, it's linked to the Son of David story, which he gives a quote in Matthew. The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I put your enemies beneath your feet. Now, that's a reference to Hebrews 10. Possibly it's referenced in other areas too of the Old or New Testament. So it's purely that they're telling you that the Son of David or the Son of Mary in context with sacrifice. So once I had lined up the Son of Mary and the Abomination of Desolation, which are correct matches in Caesar's Messiah, but there are alternative matches. So the Abomination of Desolation, in the bigger story of things and further down the line, if you read in Caesar's Messiah, the chapter on the book of Daniel, it's obviously related to the halting of the daily sacrifice. But actually, the Abomination of Desolation and the Woe Saying Jesus, although presented as being separate parallels, are all part of that one big block, right in the sort of 70% mark of the Gospels and Josephus, which is the Matthew 23 to 25. That includes the Woe Saying Jesus, it includes the Abomination of Desolation. And if you go over to the Josephus side, you will see that the word desolation is mentioned there several times. So all they wanted you to do at that stage, the Flavians, was simply to match up desolation. They didn't expect you to look at the larger context of the book of Daniel, and they wanted us to figure that out possibly later on. But at that stage, just looking for a sequence and running through all the events and the verbatim, the shared concepts, I think they just wanted us to match up desolation and match up all these other unique words like bridegroom and coming on the clouds and all these things. And then once those have been benchmarked, I call it benchmarked, once you've got the correct points of reference between Josephus and the Gospels, what then happens is it then opens up a whole new set of parallels that you can fill in the gaps. And also, looking at the Gospels harmonized or in parallel, you can match up a whole lot more. So, you know, I found that some parallels were also, in Caesar's Messiah, they were kind of mismatched just by a few paragraphs. So almost in the same story, like drive out the thieves from the temple, that was only about one or two paragraphs away. But it was all part of the dual story, but the exact words we're just a few paragraphs away. So where he talks about the corruption that Titus found in the temple, and that there was foreign donations. So there was people exchanging money in the temple with foreign donations, and there was corruption where they had made the temple a den of thieves, and people were living off the temple. And so in the Gospels, you have the story about Jesus driving the thieves out of the temple, because Jesus is obviously based on Titus and his experiences. And also, what we've already covered is that a lot of the parallels in Caesar's Messiah, they were all correct, but they were just out of context with the larger block. So they were just almost like small one-sentence parallels. So, for example, Joe splits up the demons of Gadara into about three or four different parallels. But in hindsight, now that we understand more about how the Flavians structured these books and how they are designed to be read, they are all designed to be read more as a block. So you take the entire block of the Gadara story, the demons of Gadara, and you match it with a much larger set of paragraphs in Josephus, and then you get the larger picture. And also, the new translation really helps a lot with the demons of Gadara, because they talk about the feverish nature of the Jews and how once one member of the Jews, or the Sicarii, is feverish, then they spread that fever to other people. So it's not just arming people in a neighboring village, they're actually spreading their fever.
You're absolutely right, and you've definitely seen and are creating, in my opinion, really original and good analysis as you branch out into the whole tree of typology that kind of starts simply and then gets more complicated, because there is a kind of building block aspect to the typology. And as an example, if you look at how they describe John's activities in book 7, they say, you know, he injected into the countryside 10,000 examples of wickedness. And then in the paragraph right before that, it says, well, what is a demon? And a demon is simply the spirit of wickedness. So in other words, they define the wickedness as a demon and say that John putteth 10,000 examples of them into the countryside. And I think I once wrote that if they had simply put those lines into the description of John's activity in Gadara in book 3, then you would have almost ended the Christian religion, because the whole relationship between John and Josephus and the demon of Gadara would become really vivid. And then the last thing is just that if you look at how they describe the pig's activity in the Gospels, they use really martial language. The words they choose are very, very militaristic. They describe the activities of soldiers. And so people have wondered about that, like, well, what the heck? They use the word legion to describe the pigs, but then the author expands on that and then brings in these other militarized words. And so this is an example of what you're describing, is that once you understand the connections, the simple ones, then the more complicated stuff becomes, you know, you can actually see
apparent. Yeah, speaking of John, once the second half of the book in particular was benchmarked correctly, and also some of the other parallels were put into exact position or in better context, etc., then found there's been a lot of new discoveries made thanks to the new translation of Josephus that I was using, stuff that was totally invisible in the Western translation. And again, if we had a third translation, or we had, you know, more scholarship done into Josephus, like the Gospels, because then we might learn more, even more parallels and more symbolism contained in those works. But yeah, speaking of John, what I found is probably the most important discovery that I've made is the fact he's called John the Baptist. But the parallel that I found actually shows that he's brainwashing people. John is inside the temple of Jerusalem, and he's basically brainwashing all these people by spreading false rumours that one faction in the temple has invited the Romans into Jerusalem. And he's just sort of spreading lies and sort of corrupting everyone. And then he says, it actually says in the Jewish war, only in the New Translation, not in Wisdom, it says, he has decreed a purification for tomorrow to gain entrance to the temple on a ceremonial pretext. And it was by God's providence that he had been sent to resolve the issue. And then in the part that's parallel to that in the Gospels, which is Luke 7:18-35, you have Jesus telling his disciples that they had acknowledged God's justice, having been baptized with the baptism of John. But you can see that baptism is matched to the parallel in Josephus, because they talk about purification in the ceremonial pretext. I'll just run through this one in a bit more detail, right? So John stirred up trouble between two factions in the temple. This is in Josephus. He deceived the highest priest Ananus and his party into accepting his trust, and then told the Zealots, which was the other faction in the temple, about Ananus' secret plans, pretending that they had invited the Romans to come to Jerusalem and that the Zealots should seek outside help from the Idumeans, or yet another group of people. So, trusting John's advice, the Zealots then send two messengers to the Idumeans to ask for help. But the typology shows that the Romans were actually invited, not by Ananus, but by John himself via his two messengers, asking Vespasian, "Are you the expected one, or do we look for someone else?" Now, the Romans send messengers back to John to report in so many words that the Romans are here to save the Jews. And then the Romans then addressed the Jews who had previously been under John. So they had almost like defected from John over to the Romans, and about how wicked John had grown and that he had become possessed with demons. So this is also covered in the demons of Gadara. They talk more about how John had been possessed with demons. And here they're doing it again. They're lecturing some Jews on. And John is the opposite to what the Jews expected. So, for example, in the Gospels, they say, "Did you expect someone with soft, luxurious clothing, like what a royal leader would wear?" But actually, John, because he's a rebel leader, by contrast, when you look in Josephus, he says, so you're on one side, you've got a man in soft clothing, but on the other side, you've got a man who's decked in armor. They talk about the Son of Man again in the Gospels. It's also in Matthew 11 too, the same story. If you look at the whole harmony, they say, do they think the Son of Man is he a gluttonous man and a drunkard? But in Josephus, it's actually John's men are filling their insatiable bellies and are drunk. Right. So you've got a lot of verbatim there, or shared concepts with right. gluttonous drunkard and also soft clothing and decked in armor. So the typology or the joke or the in-joke or the satire is simply that John isn't baptizing these people. He's brainwashing everyone. He's lying to them about who's invited the Romans in or who hasn't. And the only genuine holy baptisms, you could say, are being carried out by the Romans, who are kind of educating the people, supposedly in the right way, about who's really wicked here. It's not the Romans, it's John who's corrupting people. So therefore, you're better off with the Romans. So that's kind of like what they're saying there, by the looks of things.
Absolutely. Yeah. And see, this is just an example of how sophisticated the language is, that they can create these little moral messages using typology, using these building blocks. And it's just fascinating to actually go through your analysis and see all of these meanings inside the work, the typologic meanings, come to life. So it's a lot of fun to actually just go through the material as you've presented it.
Yeah. Right?
Another topic that I hope we can touch on today is that both of you guys have had some experience talking to others about the Flavian signature hypothesis and the whole Roman origins hypothesis. And I'm curious to know more about that. I've had the experience of debating this online with Richard Carrier, and he has a particular perspective, and I'm not sure how common his perspective is. Why don't you both talk about what kind of experiences you've had in outreach?
Yeah, I'm always trying to get people to look at this typology between the Gospels and Josephus. So today I actually convinced my manager he's going to actually have a look at it now. Before he wasn't so sure. Recently I actually went on a gambling forum, and I actually told these guys, I've got a gambling system that will make you a millionaire, but if you want this system and you want to become a millionaire, you've first got to tell me who is the Son of Man, and I'm going to present to you all these pieces of evidence that shows you who is the Son of Man. I want you to look at that and tell me who is the Son of Man. And unfortunately, you know, all these guys study maths and they study probability and how to beat the casino and how to get edge and things like that in their bet selections. But when it came to looking at these parallels and things, they just seemed to ignore it. They wouldn't look at it. It's been a real challenge trying to get people to look at it. They're either very ignorant, or they're just not interested, or they don't wish to give their time or attention to it, which is a shame. I just ask people really simple things like, can they acknowledge or can they confirm if there's a cluster of verbatim and concepts? But they tend to evade all the questions relating to the evidence. I don't know if it's cognitive dissonance or what it is, but one guy actually did private message me, and he actually said, "Is it Titus? Is Titus the Son of Man?" And I go, "Yeah, you got it." So he was a German guy. He actually got it out of all the whole crowd. One guy at least got it. So there's hope yet.
Absolutely. Well, you know, it's funny because I get quite a few emails, and most of them get it. They don't get it in the depth that you're getting it, Giles, but they definitely get the connection is correct. I would bet I have received in 10 years well over a couple thousand emails saying that they definitely get it. The problem is that the general scholarship is resisting it mightily for a number of reasons. And an example of that would be Richard Carrier, who recently has been claiming that the analysis is the result of mental illness. And I'm not exaggerating. I mean, literally saying this publicly in a forum, I received the videotape. And, you know, in the case of Carrier, I had a kind of long exchange with him, which was really kind of dismal because he wouldn't read the book. And I was just trying to get him to actually be interested enough in the theory to read it, but he never would read it. And to see a scholar like that kind of descend into such obvious logical fallacy, you know, it's hard really to know for sure, but I wouldn't be surprised if the exchange was just that when I brought out my response to Carrier, I think there was just simply so many errors in his critique that he was embarrassed and he just wants to distract. He's using the attack on my person as a way to get off of the analytic path. You know, he doesn't want to do any more analysis because that didn't work out well. So he's trying to just attack me as a madman, and that just gets rid of all of his troubles.
Yeah, I've seen that happen as well in other contexts with your other articles. For example, I think yesterday or the day before, you had a similar problem with another person with regards to the Shakespeare Brave New World
right,
article.
Right, 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 yeah, Jay Dwyer. What happens is that people will take the position that they understand the work, they condemn it, and then they also admit that they've never actually read it. And then if you ask any specific questions about it, then they're just completely out of gas. They don't have anything really to offer because they haven't read it. So, you know, I mean, really the hard thing is to get people to read it. Not everyone who reads it agrees with it, but the great majority do. And so, you know, that just fills me with hope for the future that so many people get it. They understand the analysis. And I think it's really important because I think that typology really needs to be understood. I think the Shakespearean language really needs to be understood, the Shakespearean typology, because this gives us an understanding of our political condition today that most people just don't get. They don't see it. So anyway, I am hopeful that, you know, more and more people will read the book, get the understanding, and then be able to understand the Shakespearean typologies. Because then when you go forward, you can see that the oligarchs have a kind of a secret language that they use to basically create legacy. They want to make sure that the people know in history, that they know their genius and what they've done.
You've got a new book coming out on that, I heard, Joe.
I do,
that's
yeah.
Still in
yeah,
the works.
Yeah, now it'll be out March of this year. It's called The Secret Language of the Oligarchs.
Wow.
Yeah, and it goes into Salinger. A lot of the stuff that's posted on the website, post-Flaviana, those are the basic components. But then it goes on into Brave New World, Huxley's book, to show exactly what he's talking about and who Huxley is and what his ethnicity is. And then it goes further into explaining movies like The Great Lebowski. The Coen brothers are very much using the typology and know the typologic system. And so I try to show people what the symbolism is that the oligarchs are using to record their control over them and how they're threatening them with this apocalypse, you know, that they seem to want to commit against the people. So that's the book's coming out.
That sounds great, Joe. I look forward to that one. You know, in Shakespeare's Secret Messiah, which is your last book, it's kind of collaborated with Jerry, you had a bit of space there to talk about the Book of Revelations and Domitian. Do you think in a new book you will get a space to talk about Trajan and his part in Christianity and Domitian's assassination, or will that have to wait for a
No, I'm going to put it in. I'm going to put it
you
in,
are?
Even though, yeah, because I showed the analysis that I had to Jerry, and I had gone a lot further and had a lot of stuff on Trajan and the Pisos and the exchange between Trajan and Pliny the Younger, which is typologic.
Wow.
So I'd done a lot of trying to decode that. And Jerry made the decision that really what we want to do is show the simplest part of Shakespeare and the simplest part of the Pauline analysis, because they're pretty complicated. The problem
is... Well, Joe, you had enough material there for three books easily.
Well, anyway, thank heavens Jerry edited it into one book. And so the hard thing is getting it in a way that it's clear, because I'm really trying to be as clear as I can. I want it to not be mysterious or hard to understand, and I want critics to be able to have exactly what I'm trying to say so they can criticize it, and if it's wrong, they can show it. All right, buddy. Everyone, thank you very much.
Okay.
All right, bye-bye.